34. It was remarkable how quickly a turbulent world could calm. In early 1974, with the war over, the country seemed to release a great exhalation of relief. The fight for rights went on, of course. Civil rights and women's rights were a constant battle, and the Stonewall riots had put gay rights in the news, too. Equality was the goal, but no longer in that hold a sign and march kind of way. The Vietnam veterans disappeared into the landscape, hiding in plain sight among a populace that either held them in contempt or considered them not at all. The hippies changed, too. They graduated from college and left their communes and cut their hair and began to look for jobs. Even the music changed. Gone was the angry protest music of the war. Now everyone sang along to John Denver and Linda Ronstadt and Elton John. The Beatles had broken up. Janis and Jimmy were dead. Frankie was fighting for a metamorphosis of her own. She had come to the inpatient center unwillingly, or maybe not that exactly. Unconscious was more like it. By February, although she felt stronger, she was well aware that she could relapse in an instant, fall again to her knees. Sometimes it felt overwhelming to think of what her life would look like from now on. So much of what had filled her up in the past few years was dark, memories, love, nightmares. She didn't know who she was without the pain or the need to hide it. But sobriety and therapy had given her the tools to heal, one day at a time. For the first time in years, she was sometimes able to imagine a future that didn't include pain or pretense. She didn't believe in soldiering on anymore and knew that trying to forget trauma only gave grim memories a fecund soil in which to grow. She accepted the loss of her nursing license and hoped to someday get it back, but she didn't take that future for granted. She still had nightmares, still sometimes woke on the floor of her dorm-like room, especially following an emotional therapy or rap session. She still longed for people who were gone from her life and whom she'd lost, but as Henry and Dr. Aldine each reminded her often, regrets were a waste of time. If only was the bend in a troubling road. She learned day by day how to navigate through life, keep going, keep moving forward. Surprisingly, of all her pains and regrets, those that had driven her to drink too much and get hooked on pills and lose her nursing license, Rye had been the easiest to exercise. She'd begun her treatment devastated by her choice to have an affair with a married man and destroyed by her belief in him and his love. She'd learned that she was weak, a sinner, but at the bottom of it all, deep down, she'd believed that Rye loved her. Love had somehow given her latitude to recast her terrible choice in a prettier light. Until the day Dr. Aldine had asked, "When did Rye first tell you he loved you?" The question brought Frankie upright on the sofa. Had Rye ever told her he loved her? She scrolled through her memories. What she found was this: "I'm afraid I'll love you till I die." At the time, she'd seen it as romantic, sweeping, epic. Now she saw the sentiment for what it was, the dark side of love. What he'd really been saying was, "I don't want to love you." It had never been real love for him. Oh, he'd shown up in Kauai to romance her, thinking that she was leaving the military within weeks and their affair would be a bit of fun before she left. She'd believed every moment with him. Worst of all, his lies had exposed an immorality in her that she could have sworn hadn't existed before him. She'd begun by believing she was stupid and learned slowly that she was just human. From now on, she would always know there was a fragility in her, and no matter how strong she became, she would have to guard against it. "I worry I don't believe in love anymore," she told Dr. Aldine once.
"But lots of people love you, Frankie, don't they?" Dr. Aldine had said.
She closed her eyes, thought of the best moments of her life, with her dad calling her Peanut and lifting her into the air, her mother holding her tightly while she cried, and Finley teaching her to surf, sharing his secrets, holding her hand. Jamie
teaching her to believe in herself, to try, no fear, McGrath. And Barb and Ethel, always there for her. Yeah, she said quietly, and let those memories be her shield, her strength, her hope. In the end, the hardest aspect of her recovery wasn't Rye. Neither was it the pills or the drugs. The thing she still grappled most violently with was Vietnam. Those were the nightmares that haunted her. She talked about it with her doctor, told him her stories, and hoped for a kind of resolution. And while talking helped, she knew that Dr. Aldean didn't understand. Not really. She saw the way he sometimes grimaced at a memory, heard words like napalm and flinched. Those moments reminded her that he had never been in war, and no one who hadn't been in the shit could really understand it. She knew, too, that when she left the safety of the inpatient center, she would be thrust back into a world where Vietnam veterans were supposed to be invisible, the women most of all. Now, though, regardless of how she felt or how the world felt about her or whether she felt ready, it was time for her to leave the center. She had been here too long already, extended her original stay, and Henry had very gently told her that she was taking the spot from someone else who needed to be saved. "You're ready," Henry said from across the desk. Frankie stood up. She didn't feel ready. By any method or measure, she had failed in the world after Vietnam. "So you and Dr. Aldean keep saying." She walked over to his bookcase, picked up a picture of his nephew Arturo in uniform. "Look at that smile," she said. "So like Finley."
"He learned discipline, that's for sure," Henry said. "My sister says she could never get him to make his bed or fold his clothes before Annapolis. Now he likes everything just so."
"There's nothing wrong with a little discipline," Frankie said. She picked up a framed photograph of Henry and his fiancée, Natalie, who were soon to be married in some woodland retreat. They were a perfect match. They spent their weekends hiking and camping and never missed a political event. She hosted fundraisers for the clinic. "You'll invite me to your hippy-dippy wedding, right?"
"Of course. You're leaving the center, Frankie. Not leaving me. We are friends. You can always call me."
She turned to look at him. He sat back in his tufted leather chair, his graying hair pulled back in a loose ponytail. "Thank you," she said. "For all of it. And I'm..."
"Love means never having to say you're sorry."
Frankie laughed. "What a crock of shit. Then again, I'm hardly an expert on love."
"You know love, Frankie."
He moved toward her, pulled her into an embrace. She held on more tightly than she should have, but in the last months, he'd become her lifeline, her anchor, her confidant. Not her doctor, but her friend, as important in a way as Barb and Ethel. "I'll miss you," she said. He touched her face.
"Just don't come back here the way you did, okay? Ask for help when you need it. Count on the people who love you, and mostly count on yourself. One day at a time. Get a sponsor. Find your passion. You've got this."
He paused, didn't look away.
"You deserve to be loved, Frankie. In that forever kind of way. Don't forget that."
Frankie stared at him for another long moment. She could tell him all of it again, how she'd learned to understand her own weakness and her own strength, how she'd come to believe that Rye was not just a liar, but selfish and cruel as well. But none of that mattered anymore. Rye didn't matter. If she saw him on the street, she'd pass him by with nothing but a pang of sad remembrance, and Henry knew all of that. "It was a lucky day when I met you, Henry Acevedo."
"Lucky for me too, Frankie."
She bent down and picked up the old, banged-up travel bag her mother had packed for her months ago, when Frankie's world had collapsed. Down the hall, she saw that Jill Landis was conducting a group session. 8 new people sat in a horseshoe in front of the therapist. A young man with long hair and slumped shoulders was saying something about heroin. Frankie paused, caught Jill's gaze, and waved. "Goodbye." Here, just like in Nam, people came, did their time, were changed in existential ways, and moved on.
Some made it in the outside world, some didn't. It was especially bad with Vietnam vets. The statistics on their rates of suicide were becoming alarming. Frankie didn't go back to her room, vaguely afraid that once there, she would find a reason not to leave. She walked through the front doors, out into the cold day. She saw her mother's black Cadillac parked beneath a jacaranda tree. The driver's side door opened, then the passenger side. Dad and Mom stepped out, stood at their respective sides of the car, looking at her. Even from here, she saw their joy and their anxiety. She had given them so much to worry about in a few short years. Vietnam, trauma, the miscarriage, Rye, the drunk driving, the pills. She knew how hard all of it was on two people for whom reputation and standing in the community were vital. She had no idea what they had told their friends this time. Maybe drug and alcohol treatment had become tagging penguins in Antarctica. Either way, she wouldn't ask. Having discovered her own failings, she was less inclined to judge others. Her parents didn't understand her, perhaps, and certainly they didn't condone most of her choices, but they were here. You know love, Frankie. Frankie walked across the gravel parking lot. Francis, Mom said at her approach. A look passed between them, a sharing of emotion between mother and daughter. You look good, Mom said. Too thin. You too, Frankie said, walking into her mother's arms, being held in the new, fierce way that Mom had developed. Like Frankie, Mom had learned how capricious life and one's own body could be. When Mom finally let go, with tears in her eyes, Frankie turned, looked across the shiny black roof of the Cadillac at her dad. She had aged him, she knew. Taught him that success and money couldn't insulate a family from loss or hardship. Walls around a house were no guarantee of safety, not in a world that was constantly shifting. He'd changed with the times, in a way, grown out his sideburns and traded in his custom suits for knit bowling-style shirts and double-knit pants, but there was no denying the wariness in his eyes when he looked at his daughter. She remembered him carrying her out of the water that night. The memory of his crying would always be with her. What he'd learned about her that night, about them, could never be erased. She knew a part of him would worry about her forever, and that he would never say a word about it. He and her mother were of a quieter generation. They didn't believe in words as much as they believed in optimism and hard work.
I think you look great, Frankie, he said.
Thanks, Dad. She opened the back door, tossed her bag in the back seat, and slid in next to it. When Dad started the engine, Perry Como's voice sang through the speakers and pulled time away. Suddenly, Frankie was 10 years old again, sitting in the back seat of the car, sliding across at every turn in the road, bumping into her brother.
That bag still smells mildewed, Mom said. I don't see how that's possible.
Monsoon season, Frankie said. Staring down at the black, soft-sided bag that had gone around the world with her. Everything was wet. Nothing ever dried.
That must have been unpleasant, Mom said.
The first real conversation they'd ever had about Vietnam. Frankie couldn't help smiling. They were trying, hoping to change in small and meaningful ways.
Yeah, Mom, she said with a smile. It was unpleasant.
They pulled up in front of the small gray beach bungalow with its old-fashioned wishing well out front and the American flag hanging over the garage door.
You could stay with us,
Dad said in a gruff voice. Frankie understood his worry. No one wanted to leave an addict alone for long, but she needed to stand on her own, or fall. And if she fell, she needed to stand again. I'll be okay here, Dad. She saw the way he frowned, nodded. He reached across for Mom's hand, held it. Frankie nodded, grabbed her bag, and got out of the car and stood there for a moment. Mom got out of the car and hugged Frankie.
Don't scare me again, Mom whispered.
Frankie felt a surge of love for her mother, a kinship. She thought suddenly about what it meant to lose a child. When Frankie was young, it had bothered her mother's sturdy impassivity, her calm demeanor. But now Frankie knew better. You survived a day at a time, however you could. Tomorrow, Frankie would begin the work of day-at-a-time living. She'd find a local Alcoholics Anonymous meeting and get a sponsor. Then she'd send Mr. Brightman a check for a new bicycle, the first step in her lengthy reparation process. She would not seek to reinstate her nursing license until she was sure of her recovery. Mom laid a hand on Frankie's cheek, looked deeply into her eyes. I am so proud of you, Frances. Thank you, Mom. Letting go of her mother, Frankie turned and headed for the cottage. The deed, in Frankie's name, lay on the kitchen counter. No doubt her father had put it there to remind her that she belonged here, on Coronado. She went to her bedroom and tossed her bag on the floor, where it landed with a thunk and slid bumpily across the wooden planks. Then she walked down the hallway to the nursery. When had she last opened that door? She opened it now and stood in the doorway, staring at the yellow room. For the first time, she let herself remember all of it, here, in this room where she'd once been filled with hope. A different version of her, a different world. As she stood there, letting the pain in, remembering the whole of her life, she realized, suddenly, that she was young, not even 29. She'd made some of the most momentous choices in her life before she had any idea of consequences. Some had been thrust on her, some had been expected, some had been impetuous. She'd decided to become a nurse at 17. She'd joined the Army Nurse Corps and gone to war at 21. She'd gone to Virginia with her friends to run away from home, and when her mother needed care, she'd come home. In love, she'd been too cautious for years, and then too impetuous. In retrospect, it all felt haphazard. Some good decisions, some bad, some experiences that she would never trade. What she'd learned about herself in Vietnam and the friendships she'd made were indelible. But now, it was time to actually go in search of her life. Summer 1974. The air smelled of childhood, of the sea and sand baked by the sun and lemon trees. On Ocean Boulevard, Frankie tented a hand over her eyes and stared out at the wide blue Pacific. She imagined a pair of black-haired, blue-eyed kids running across the sand, carrying surfboards. Kids who'd thought they had all the time in the world to grow up, who didn't know what it meant to be broken, or afraid, or lost. Hey, Finn, I miss you. She walked along the sidewalk on her way home from an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting with the long white beach on her left. A tuft of greenery capped the rise. In the distance, boats moved across the horizon. Tourists and locals filled the beach on this hot August day. A jet roared overhead, probably a pilot from that new fighter jet school at Miramar. The roar of the engines was loud enough to shake the ground. She knew that no one on Coronado cared. They called it the sound of freedom. At the gate to her parents' house, Frankie paused, steeled herself for what she was sure would be a battle, and opened the gate. It had taken months of hard work to get to this place, and still it was just the beginning. Often, as she'd begun to contemplate her future, she'd panicked, felt weak, thought, "I can't do this." On those hard days, she either went to a second or third meeting, or called her sponsor and found just enough strength to keep going, keep believing, one day at a time. Today, the yard was awash in summer color. Dad was on the patio, smoking a cigarette. She closed the gate behind her and walked around the pool to stand in front of him. She fought the urge to say she was sorry. Again. She'd said it to him dozens of times in the past few months, and she knew how uncomfortable it made him. At first, she'd hoped her apology would be a beginning, the start of reparations, maybe, a healing that could only come through conversation.
She longed to tell him he'd hurt her and understand why he'd been so cold and dismissive about her service in Vietnam. But it was not to be. He had no interest in talking about it. He wanted to pretend the war had never torn this family apart. Dr. Aldean had taught her to accept that, accept him. That was what family meant. Sometimes hurts didn't quite heal. That was life.
I need to talk to you guys, she said.
That doesn't sound good.
Frankie smiled. I know how you love to talk. She took hold of his hand, squeezed it. He squeezed back. Mom came out onto the patio, a glass of iced tea in one hand.
Our girl wants to talk to us,
Dad said.
That doesn't sound good, Mom said.
There was something to be said for consistency. Frankie led her parents into the living room, where a sofa and four chairs were gathered around a huge stone fireplace. Frankie sat in one of the big wing chairs. Her parents sat together on the sofa. Frankie saw her mother reach out to hold her father's hand. Frankie thought, oddly, of that night long ago when she'd dressed with such care for Finley's going-away party, in a lavender sheath with her hair teased to an improbable height. She'd done everything to make these two people proud of her. It was why her father's dismissal of Vietnam cut so deeply. But those were the needs of a child. She was a woman now. I love you guys, she said. That was the starting and ending point in life. Love. The journey was everything in between. Mom paled visibly.
Francis. No fear,
Frankie said, more to herself than to her mother, who was obviously imagining the worst. She took a deep breath, exhaled.
I've had plenty of time to think in the past few months. I've worked really hard to become honest with myself and to see my own life clearly, and maybe I still don't. Maybe no one ever does until it's too late. But I've seen enough. I need to find out who I really am and who I want to be.
You'll get your nursing license back. Henry says he'll write you a recommendation. You just have to start the process, Mom said. And you've gotten your driver's license back.
I know that. I hope to God I can be a nurse again, but I have to plan for the worst, too, that they deny me.
What is it you're trying to say, Frankie?
Dad asked.
I'm moving, she said.
What? Mom said.
Why? You have everything you need right here.
Can you make it on your own?
Dad said.
Without your nursing license?
Frankie had asked herself the same thing. She'd never paid rent, or found her own place, or lived alone. She'd gone from her parents' house straight to her hooch in Vietnam. The last time she'd lost her shit, Barb and Ethel had bailed her out and given her a place to live. While she'd been in recovery, her father had hired a lawyer and gotten her DUI downgraded to reckless driving and gotten her driver's license reinstated. She'd never even had her own credit card.
I don't know where I'm going or what I'm looking for, but you know what? That's okay. It's supposed to be frightening to make your way in the world, to leave your family.
Oh,
Mom said, looking hurt.
I need quiet, Frankie said. Everything has been loud since Vietnam. Before that, maybe, since Finley's death. I need to live someplace where all I hear are leaves rustling and winds blowing and maybe a coyote howling at the moon, where I can focus on getting well, strong. I want to have an animal, a dog, maybe, a horse.
She paused.
I just want to breathe easily. Thanks to both of you, I have the cottage. I'd like to sell it and use the money to start over somewhere new.
Her parents stared at her for a long moment.
We'll worry, Mom said at last.
Frankie loved her for that.
It's not like I'm going to war, she said with a smile.
I'll be back, and you'll visit wherever I end up. On a hot, late August day, Frankie packed up her repaired Mustang and went back into the bungalow, tossing her keys on the counter. She looked around at the empty room. She hoped a young family bought this place and raised their children here, letting them run as free as she and Finley had, that they loved the tree swing Henry had put up in the backyard,
and had birthday parties on the beach. At last, she left the house, closed the door behind her for the last time. Outside, Barb stood against Frankie's Mustang with her arms crossed. In front of her was a for sale sign stuck into the lawn.
"Hey," she said.
Frankie laughed out loud.
"Who called you? Mom? Henry? I'm surrounded by snitches."
"Uh-huh. You didn't think I'd let you go and search your life alone, did you?"
"You're married, with stepkids. You don't have to sweep in and fill my empty life with your own, you know."
Barb rolled her eyes.
"You're my best friend, Frankie," she said.
And that was it.
"Ethel wanted to come, but she's pregnant again, on bed rest. She said to tell you she's here in big, fat spirit."
An ice cream truck drove past, bells jingling. The neighborhood children wouldn't be far behind. Frankie turned, tented her eyes. For a split second, she was 10 years old again, running along behind her big brother, trying to keep up, both of them gilded in sunlight in her memory. Frankie laughed and hugged Barb, then jumped in the driver's seat and started the car. The music came on loudly, hooked on a feeling. A few blocks later, Frankie eased her foot off the gas. Her parents stood in front of the gate, arms around each other, hands in the air. How long had they been there, waiting to catch a glimpse of her as she left town? They'd said goodbye a dozen times and in a dozen ways in the last month. Frankie waved and honked the horn in goodbye to her parents, to Coronado, to her childhood, and to Finley. The Mustang rolled through town and onto the bridge, past the boats anchored in the harbor. Frankie saw the postcard beauty of Coronado Island in her rearview mirror. With no destination in mind, Frankie and Barb drove north, listening to Creedence, Vanilla Fudge, Cream, Janis, The Beatles, The Animals, Dylan, The Doors. The music of Vietnam. The music of their generation. At Dana Point, Frankie turned onto Highway 1 and stayed on the coast, with the endless blue Pacific to her left. In Long Beach, there was an accident, so she turned onto a freeway and then another one, just taking exits when it felt right. She let the complex web of California freeways become her will. She let them lead her, this way and that. With the new 55-mile-per-hour speed limit, she had to constantly check her speed. She drove through downtown Los Angeles, with its graffiti and gangs and chain-link fences, and found herself on the glittering Sunset Strip, a world of lights and giant billboards and music clubs. They drove up the magnificent California coast, spent a few nights in the Santa Ynez Valley, staring out at the rolling golden hills, and Frankie said,
"I like the open spaces, but I need more, and horses, maybe."
"Northward," Barb said. This was how they made decisions, on the fly, by corners turned and roads taken and not taken. In Carmel, the afternoon fog was too heavy. In San Francisco, there were too many people. The wildness of Mendocino called out to her, but the giant sequoias hemmed her in somehow. So, northward. In Oregon, the green was vibrant and the air was clean, and still there were too many people, even though the towns were few and far between. They bypassed busy Seattle, listened to radio reports of missing college girls, and turned east, passing through the empty, endless wheat fields in the eastern half of Washington, which felt lonely to Frankie, desolate. Montana. When they drove into the town of Missoula, singing about time in a bottle, the sky was a vibrant, searing blue that explained the Big Sky Country moniker. A few miles out of town, and the view was stunning. Hay fields that stretched toward jagged, snow-capped mountains, their peaks draped in snow, the wide blue Clark Fork River meandering by. For sale, 27 acres. She and Barb saw the sign at the same time. It was stuck on a slanted post, looked weathered by time. Behind it, an endless green field, the river running along it, a ragged barbed wire fence in need of tending, a dirt road that led to a stand of tall green trees. Frankie looked at Barb.
"It's beautiful. And remote," Barb said.
A girl could breathe here, Frankie said.
She turned onto the dirt road, followed it into a thicket of trees and out again. Beyond the trees lay another vibrant green field, with the mountains rising behind them into the blue sky. Frankie stared through the dirty windshield at the peak-roofed farmhouse with a wraparound porch, at the fenced horse fields, at the big, old, once-red barn in need of a new roof. There were outbuildings, too, some of them collapsed, more barely standing.
This is a shitload of work, Barb said.
Fortunately, I know how to fix stuff.
Frankie turned, smiled.
My friends and I spent almost 2 years rebuilding a bunkhouse.
It's in the middle of nowhere.
Look at the map. Missoula isn't far. Hospitals and a college, too. It's closer to Chicago than San Diego is. I know I can find an AA meeting here, get a new sponsor.
You've made up your mind.
Frankie turned off the radio.
Quiet.
She looked at Barb, smiled.
I have.
35. Western Montana, September 1982. The invitation came in a smudged white envelope that was postmarked August 28th and stamped Washington, D.C. Someone had written across the back, "Save the date." You're invited to a reunion of the 36th EVAC hospital staff following the unveiling of the new Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. on November 13th, 1982. Frankie's first reaction surprised her. Anger. Now a memorial to the men who had died? Now? More than a decade after they'd been unceremoniously buried and forgotten by their fellow Americans? As hard as Frankie had worked in the last 8 years, and she'd been dedicated to the endeavor, she'd never quite been able to completely dispel the shame her fellow Americans had made her feel over serving in Vietnam, nor her anger at how the government had treated the veterans who returned broken in body or mind or spirit. Even worse than that, in the late 70s, she'd sat here in her living room and watched a fellow Vietnam vet claim on television that Agent Orange had given him and thousands like him cancer. "I died in Vietnam. I just didn't know it," he'd said. Not long after that, the world had learned that the herbicide also caused miscarriages and birth defects. Most likely, it had caused Frankie's miscarriage. Her own government had done that to her. Maybe if the politicians in Washington, D.C. had built this memorial as an apology to a generation of servicemen and women and their families, she might have felt differently. But no. The government hadn't moved to honor the veterans of Vietnam. The vets themselves had had to make this happen. Those who remained, honoring those who had fallen. She heard Donna come up behind her. Pause. Donna had worked here at the ranch for more than 7 years now. Frankie still remembered the cold day Donna had driven up to the front door, her fake black hair every which way, her skin pale from alcoholism, her voice barely above a whisper.
"I'm a nurse," she'd said. "Coochie, 68. I got your name from the VA. I can't."
"Sleep," Frankie remembered saying. That was all. Enough. Everything. She'd taken Donna by the hand and led her into the farmhouse. They'd sat in a pair of folding chairs in front of the fire and talked. A rap session, Jill at the center had called it. It helps sometimes to feel you're not alone. They'd been there for each other, she and Donna, often held each other upright. Donna had urged Frankie to fight for the reinstatement of her nursing license, and the fight had proven to be healing. By the time she'd officially been granted the right to be a nurse again, Frankie felt strong enough to try. That had been the beginning of the ranch. She and Donna had joined forces, using the money from the Coronado Cottage sale to make improvements. In Missoula, both of them took nursing jobs at a local hospital. After work hours, Frankie attended night classes at the college toward a degree in clinical psychology, and a year later, Donna did the same. When they weren't studying to become counselors or working shifts at the hospital, they remodeled the house and repaired the outbuildings and attended regular meetings. That first summer, Frankie's friends and family had shown up to help. Mom and Dad, Barb and Jer and their growing boys, Ethel and Noah and their two kids, Henry and Natalie and their rowdy sons. They took over bedrooms and pitched tents in the grassy backyard. They worked together during the day and sat around a campfire at night, talking and laughing and remembering. As soon as they got their master's degrees, Frankie and Donna put up flyers at the nearest Veterans Administration office that said, "To the women of Vietnam, we lived through it over there. We can live through it here. Join us." A year later, Janet had shown up, her face blackened by bruising, her quick laugh too sharp to be anything but a substitute for crying. Janet stayed for almost a year. From then on, the ranch they called the Last Best Place became a haven for the women who'd served in Vietnam. They came, they stayed as long as they needed to, and they moved on. Each left an imprint somehow, a path for women like them to follow. They left art and easels and paints, knitting needles and skeins of wool, short stories and memoir chapters and musical instruments. They worked during the day, hammering nails, painting walls, feeding horses, tending the garden, whatever needed doing. They learned to breathe, and then to talk, and then, if they were lucky, to hope. Frankie taught them the healing power of words and the joy of finding quiet. Peace, at least the beginning of it, was the goal. But it was never easy. The beautiful, unexpected byproduct of helping other women was that Frankie found her own passion again, her own pride. She loved this place fiercely, loved the life she'd forged in the wilderness, loved the women who came to her for help and helped her in return. She woke up each morning with hope. And each summer, her friends and family showed up to spend as much vacation time as possible on the ranch. It became a haven for them, too. "Group is ready." Frankie nodded, looking down at the silver POW bracelet she still wore for the major who'd never come home. Donna came up beside her. In the years they'd worked together, both women had filled out, gotten physically strong by pounding fence posts and hauling hay bales and tossing saddles up on their horses' backs. Both routinely wore Levi's, cowboy boots, and flannel shirts. No shoulder pads or power suits in this part of Montana. "There's a lot of talk about the memorial," Donna said. "Lots of reunions are happening." "Yeah," Frankie said. "It's a lot to think about." They stood side by side, staring through the kitchen window, out at the autumn fields. Each knew what the other was thinking. They'd talked about it often enough. Taking her cup of coffee, Frankie left the kitchen, heard Donna behind her, putting a pot of beans on to soak. Outside, the world was awash in fall color. Snow lay heavily on the jagged, distant mountains. Skiing would come early this year. The brilliant blue of the Clark Fork River meandered through the fields, swirled and bubbled over polished stones, made a sound like children laughing. The Last Best Place ranch now boasted a whitewashed farmhouse with three bedrooms and two bathrooms. The furniture was all secondhand garage sale finds, as well as the stuff Mom had shipped up years ago from the bungalow when it sold. Here, women had painted through their pain and left images on the walls, a kind of graffiti. One wall, Frankie called it the hero's wall, was filled with photographs of the women who'd served, those who'd come through the ranch, and others, their friends. Hundreds of photographs were tacked onto the pine planks. In the center was the picture of Barb, Ethel, and Frankie standing in front of the O Club at the 36th EVAC. Across the top of it all, Frankie had painted in bold black script, "The Women." Three refurbished bunkhouses held bunk beds and writing desks. A fourth had been turned into a communal bathroom with showers and sinks and toilets. The barn was still a little undone, but the roof was solid now, and seven horses lived in the stalls. Frankie had learned how beneficial caring for animals and riding could be for women in crisis. In the center aisle of the barn, 6 folding chairs had been set in a semicircle on the sawdust floor. On this cool morning, 4 of the chairs were occupied by women. Frankie took her chair and pulled it closer and sat down. The women looked at her, one in a shuddered, closed-off way, one in anger, one who seemed almost disinterested, and a 4th woman was already crying.
"I got an invitation to a reunion of the 36th Evac," Frankie said. "It's tied into the unveiling of the Vietnam Veterans Memorial. I suspect some of you may have gotten invitations too."
"Ha," Gwen said. She was older looking, but not old, just worn out, her mouth flattened, her eyes dark with anger. "Like I want to remember," she said sharply. "I spent half my waking hours trying to forget."
"I'm going to go," the crying woman, Liz, said. "To pay my respects. This memorial matters, Gwen."
"Too little, too late," said Marcy, who leaned forward in her seat, put her forearms on her thighs. It was her first full day at the ranch, and she didn't believe in any of it yet. "I am done with Vietnam, Liz," Gwen said. "Everyone always tells me to forget, to let it go. And now I'm supposed to go running back? Nope, not me, not going."
"You'll disappoint the people you served with," said Ramona.
"What's new?" Gwen said. "I've disappointed pretty much everyone since I got home." Frankie had heard these words from every woman who'd come through the ranch, trying to right themselves after the war. She knew what they needed to hear.
"You know, I wasn't afraid to go to war, and I should have been. I am afraid to go to the memorial, and I shouldn't be. People made us think we'd done something wrong. Shameful, didn't they? We were forgotten. All of us Vietnam vets, but the women most of all."
The women nodded. Frankie looked at the women, recognized their emotional wounds, and felt their pain.
"I used to wonder if I would do it again, join up. Was there still a believer inside me, a last shred of the girl who wanted to make a difference?" She looked around. "And I would. In some ways, the war years were the best of my life."
"And the worst," Gwen said. Frankie looked at Gwen, saw the woman's anger, remembered it.
"And the worst," she agreed. "You're right, Gwen. I don't think disappointing people is a reason to go to the memorial. Most of us have made too many decisions based on other people. We need to do what we need to do. But we've been silenced for too long, invisible for too many years."
"It's all about the men," Gwen said. "Did I tell you I tried to join a Vietnam vets talk therapy session in Dallas? It's always the same thing. You don't belong. You're a woman. There were no women in Vietnam."
The women in the circle nodded at that.
"We don't have a memorial," Gwen added.
"We share that pain, don't we?" Frankie said.
"We've been dealing with the war for a decade, most of us, some even longer, pushing through. I know how the Agent Orange news has brought it all back up," Frankie said. It was a topic that came up consistently in the circle.
"I had 4 miscarriages," Liz said, tears bright in her eyes. "A baby might have saved me, us, you know? And all that time they were spraying that shit, killing us all slowly."
"Sometimes I think dying would be easier than living this way," Gwen said. "We'll probably all get cancer."
Frankie looked at each woman in turn, saw the variations on pain.
"Who here has considered suicide?" she asked.
A taboo question that she asked in each new group of women. Gwen said,
"I've thought it might be a relief to disappear."
"That's a brave thing to say. But we know you're brave, Gwen. All of you are. And you're tough."
"I used to be,"
Liz said.
"You're here," Frankie said. "In the wilds of Montana, sitting in a barn that smells like manure and saying the most frightening, intimate things out loud to strangers."
She took a beat. "But we aren't strangers, are we? We are the women who went to war, the nurses of Vietnam, and many of us felt silenced at home. We lost who we were, who we wanted to be. But I'm living proof that it can get better. You can get better. It starts here, in these chairs, reminding ourselves and each other that we are not alone." In Washington, D.C., on the morning of November 13, 1982, Frankie woke well before dawn. She'd hardly slept last night. If she'd still been a drinking woman, she would have poured herself something strong. She almost wished she was still a smoker. She needed something to do with her hands. As it was, she got up at 5 a.m. and pulled her old black overnight bag out of the closet of her cheap motel room. She could have brought a new suitcase on this trip, but the travel bag just felt right. It had been with her in the beginning, in Vietnam. It should be with her now at the end. It landed on the cheap shag carpet floor with a thunk. She clicked on the bedside lamp, knelt in the pool of light, and unzipped the bag. The smells assailed her. Sweat and mud and blood and smoke and fish. Vietnam. Don't drink the water. I'm new in country. No shit. That's us giving it back to them. On top of her belongings was a Polaroid picture taken at the O Club. In it, Ethel, Barb, and Frankie all wore shorts and t-shirts and combat boots. Jamie had an arm around Frankie's waist and held up a beer in a toast. There was a picture of her dancing with Jamie, both of them sweaty and laughing, and another one of the guys playing volleyball in the sunlight while the women watched, and one of Hap playing his guitar. Look at those smiles. Good times. They'd had those too. Frankie pulled out her battered old boonie hat and felt a wave of nostalgia thinking of all the places where she'd worn this hat, all the time she'd had to hold it down so rotor wash didn't whip it off her head. A dozen pins and patches decorated it, mementos her patients had given her, both from platoons and squadrons, even a happy face pin and a peace symbol. When had she written "Make Love, Not War" across the brim in magic marker? She didn't remember. She'd worn this hat on her medcap trips into the villages and on her supply flights to Long Binh, on the beach, and even on her R&R to Kauai. She'd worn it handing out candy to kids at the orphanages and sitting in the back of a deuce and a half, bumping over red dirt roads and splashing through rivers of mud. And she would wear it today. No more hiding this treasured memento away in her closet, trying to forget the woman who'd worn it. No more hiding at all. She pulled out her dog tags, held them in her hand for the first time in years, surprised by how light they actually were. They'd taken on a weight in her mind. She thought of all the bloody dog tags she'd held in her life as she looked for a wounded man's name, blood type, religion. Some women had worn love beads in the 60s. Others had worn dog tags. She pulled out the stack of Polaroid pictures of Vietnam she'd brought, remembering the night, years ago now, at the ranch, when her mother had asked to see them, when they'd sat outside by a fire, a spray of stars overhead, and looked at these faded photographs of nurses and doctors, soldiers, Vietnamese children herding water buffalo along the banks of a river, green jungles, white beaches, old men in rice paddies. Mom hadn't said much, but she'd sat there, listening, for hours. Frankie pulled out the latest of her journals. She'd first begun journaling in rehab at Henry's urging. Her first sentence, written all those years ago in angry black marker, was, "How did I end up here? I am so ashamed." In the years between then and now, she'd written hundreds of pages. They initially chronicled her pain, and then her recovery, and finally her coming of age in Montana, on the land where she had found herself, her calling, and her passion. She didn't have children, imagined now that she would never have children, but she had her ranch and the women who came to her. She had friends and family and a purpose. She had the big, full life she and her brother had once dreamed of. She opened up the first blank page, dated it, and wrote, "I can't stop thinking about Finley today. Of course. Mom and Dad chose not to come to the unveiling of the memorial. I wish they were here. I need them here, but I understand. Some grief is too deep to reveal in public. We were the last believers, my generation. We trusted what our parents taught us about right and wrong, good and evil, the American myth of equality and justice and honor. I wonder if any generation will ever believe again. People will say it was the war that shattered our lives and laid bare the beautiful lie we'd been taught. And they'd be right and wrong. There was so much more. It's hard to see clearly when the world is angry and divided and you're being lied to. God, I wish we... There was a knock at the door. Frankie wasn't surprised. Who could sleep? She got up, went to the door, opened it. Barb and Ethel stood outside, beneath a feeble overhead light. A sputtering neon sign in the parking lot behind them read, "No vacancy."
"Smells like Nom," Ethel said. "I wish you'd let me pay for nicer rooms."
"It's her damn overnight bag," Barb said.
"I have to be careful with money these days," Frankie said.
The three of them left the room, each wearing whatever they'd worn to sleep in, and walked down the stairs to a kidney-shaped pool that needed cleaning. Lights in the water created an aqua glow, as did the few lights on the exterior of the motel. The neon sign gave off a faint bee-like buzzing sound.
$6 and you get a pool," Barb said, sitting in a creaky lounge chair.
"For $7, they might clean the pool," Ethel said, sitting beside her.
"I'd rather they wash the sheets," Barb said.
"Quit complaining, you two. We're here, aren't we?" Frankie said, stretching out on the chair between them.
"Last night, I dreamt about our first night in the 71st, Barb said, lighting a cigarette. "Haven't thought about that in years."
Ethel said, "For me, it was my first napalm orphanage shift."
Frankie stared out at the water in the dirty pool with the chain-link fence around it all. She'd had those nightmares, too, and they'd wakened her, too, gotten her heart pumping. But she'd also dreamt of water skiing on the Saigon River, of coyotes' howl, of Jamie's smile, and dancing to the Doors with her girlfriends. She'd surprised herself by thinking about Rye for the first time in years and found there was nothing left in her that cared about him. All that remained was a patched and faded regret.
"It's going to be crazy today," Ethel said. "A huge crowd."
"We hope," Barb said.
They all considered that, feared it, the unveiling of a memorial to a war and warriors that no one seemed eager to remember.
"We're here," Frankie said. "That's enough for me."
In a way, even with as far as she'd come, Frankie feared that the vein of fragility in her would open up when confronted again with Vietnam and all that had been lost there. This morning, she stared at herself in the mirror, dressed in her fatigues, seeing the young version of herself staring back. She attached her ANC pin to her collar. Outside the motel, in full daylight, she met up with Barb and Ethel. Their husbands and children would be meeting them at the memorial. This, the beginning, was just for the girlfriends. Each was wearing her fatigues and boonie hat and combat boots. Barb smiled.
"Don't tell me there were no women in Vietnam."
A ceiling of white clouds lay over the city. The air smelled crisp and cold of the coming winter. Here on the cordoned-off street, Vietnam veterans gathered, thousands of men dressed in uniforms and fatigues, leather jackets with military patches on the sleeves, and torn jeans. There were veterans in wheelchairs and on crutches, some blinded and being helped along by friends. Thousands and thousands of Vietnam veterans coming together for the first time in a decade or more. There was a feeling of reunion, joy, men clapping each other on the back, laughing, hugging. Someone with a bullhorn yelled out,
"Brothers, let's go pay our respects!"
And the crowd began to form itself into a parade line. Frankie and Ethel and Barb joined the line of men. Someone started to sing "America the Beautiful," and others joined in, hesitantly, and then boldly. Their voices swelled in song. "And crown thy good with brotherhood, from sea to shining sea." Frankie heard her friends and fellow veterans singing beside her. Spectators applauded from the sidewalks. Car horns honked. As they neared the National Mall, the vets fell quiet all at once, with no one urging the sudden stillness. No more singing, no talking, no clearing of throats even.
They walked together, shoulder to shoulder, these men who'd fought in a hated war and come home to animosity and still didn't know how to feel about what they'd lived through. Helicopters flew in formation overhead. As far as Frankie could see, the three of them were the only women, although they searched the crowd for nurses or donut dollies or other military women with whom they'd served. At the mall, an American flag fluttered in the cool breeze above a trio of bright red fire trucks. Supporters filled the grassy area, lined the reflecting pool, waited for the parade of veterans. Children on their parents' shoulders, families huddled together, mothers holding framed pictures of their lost sons, dogs barking, babies screaming. Five jets flew overhead. One peeled off from the rest. The missing man formation. The welcome home these veterans had never received. Veterans dispersed into the waiting crowd, joined their families, gathered in pods of old friends who hadn't seen each other in years. "Come with me," Barb said, tugging on Frankie's hand. Frankie shook her head. "Go, girls. Be with your families. We'll meet up."
"You want to be alone?" Ethel said.
Frankie bit back her instinctive response. "I am alone."
"Go,"
she said again, quietly. Frankie moved forward on her own, through the crowd. And then, there it was. The wall. Gleaming black granite rising up from the green grass, the shiny surface alive with reflected movement. Honor guards stood stationed at intervals along it. Frankie was overwhelmed by the sight of it. Even from here, she could see the endless etchings on the stone, more than 58,000 names. A generation of men. And 8 women. Nurses. All of them. Names of the fallen. In the distance, somewhere, someone tapped on a microphone, made a scratching, squealing sound that drew the attention of the crowd. A man's voice rang out. "No one can debate the sacrifice and the service of those who fell while serving. Standing before this monument, we see reflected in a dark mirror dimly a chance now to let go of the pain, the grief, the resentment, the bitterness, the guilt." As the speech went on, the speaker remarked on the world the veterans had come home to and the shame now felt by Americans who hadn't welcomed their soldiers home. At last, the speaker said the words that Frankie and her fellow veterans had waited for all these years. "Welcome home, and thank you." The soldier next to Frankie began to cry. The veterans sang "God Bless America." Their family and the visitors joined in. At the end of the song, with the last notes echoing across the mall, the speaker said, "Ladies and gentlemen, the Vietnam Veterans Memorial is now dedicated." A cheer rose up from the crowd, a thunderous applause. Someone else stepped up to the podium, a grizzled, old-before-his-time vet in stained fatigues. "Thank you for finally remembering us." Reporters and cameramen pushed through the crowd, seeking statements for the nightly news. Frankie drifted down the sloping grass, drawn to the wall. She saw women holding framed photographs of the men they'd lost, and a teenager wearing his father's too-big dress uniform. As she neared the mirror of black granite, she saw her own reflection, a skinny, long-haired woman in fatigues and a boonie hat, superimposed over the names of the fallen. She glanced down the black line, saw men in uniform standing tall in front of it, while women knelt before it, children and parents at their sides. "Francis." She turned and saw her parents moving toward her.
"You came,"
Frankie said, overwhelmed with emotion. Her mother held a framed photograph of Finley to her chest. Dad held tightly onto Mom's other hand.
"I wanted to see his name," Mom said quietly. "My son. He would want me here."
The three of them moved as one to the wall, searched the names and dates. There he was, Finley O. McGrath. Frankie reached out to touch the stone. To her surprise, it was warm. She traced the etching of her brother's name, remembering the sound of his laughter, the way he teased her,
the stories he read her before bed. I'm going to be a great American novelist. Here, Frankie, that's your wave. Paddle hard. You got it.
Hey, Finn, she said. It felt good to think of him as he was, as he'd been, not just as a casualty of war, but as a beloved brother. For too many years, all she'd thought of was his death. Now, at the wall, she remembered his life. She heard her mother crying, and the soft, wrenching sound of it brought tears to Frankie's eyes too, blurred her vision.
He's here, Frankie said. I feel him.
I always feel him,
her mother said in a voice that held on to sorrow. Beside her, Dad stood rigid, his jaw clenched, afraid even here to show his grief.
Ma'am?
Frankie felt someone tap on her shoulder and say again,
Ma'am?
She turned. The man who'd tapped her shoulder was maybe her age, with long sideburns and a straggly beard. He wore torn and stained fatigues. He pulled off his boonie hat, which held patches from the 101st.
Ma'am, were you a nurse over there?
Frankie almost asked how he knew. Then she remembered that she was wearing her fatigues and boonie hat and her winged ANC pin.
I was, she said, studying the man, trying to remember him. Had she held his hand, or written a letter for him, or taken a picture with him, or brought him a glass of water?
If she had, she didn't recall it. She felt her father step closer to her.
Frankie, do you?
Frankie held up a hand for silence. For once, her father complied. The soldier reached out to hold her hand, stared into her eyes. In that moment, on the mall ground with the wall shining beside them, the two of them shared it all. The horror, the grief, the pain, the pride, the guilt, the camaraderie. She thought, here we are, for the first time since the war, all of us together.
Thank you, ma'am,
he said, and she nodded and let him go. Frankie felt her father's gaze on her. She turned, looked up at him, saw the tears in his eyes.
Finley loved his service, Dad. We wrote letters all the time. He found himself over there. You don't need to feel guilty.
You think I feel guilty for urging my son to go to war? I do. It's a thing I live with.
He swallowed hard.
But I feel more guilt about how I treated my daughter when she came home.
Frankie drew in a sharp breath. How long had she waited to hear those words from him?
You're the hero, aren't you, Frankie?
Tears blurred her vision.
I don't know about a hero, Dad, but I served my country. Yeah.
I love you, Peanut,
he said in a rough voice.
And I'm sorry.
Peanut. God, he hadn't called her that in years.
Frankie saw him crying and wished she knew the perfect words to say, but nothing came to her. Life was like that, she guessed. It was all wrong until suddenly it was right, and you didn't really know how to react in either instance. But she knew love when she saw it, and it filled her.
I don't know about heroism, she said, but I saw a lot of it, and she drew in a deep breath. I'm proud of my service, Dad. It's taken me a long time to say that. I'm proud, even if the war never should have happened, even if it went to hell.
Her father nodded. She could see that he wanted more from her, absolution, maybe. But there was time ahead for that. This, here, was her time, her moment, her memories. She left her parents standing in front of Finley's name and walked along the wall, looking for 1967 to 1969, seeing the flowers and pictures and yearbooks that were being set up at the base of the black granite. She saw a Gold Star mother standing beside a pair of confused-looking teenagers trying to construct their lost father from letters carved into granite. She followed the line of names, looking for Jameson Callahan.
McGrath.
Frankie stopped. He stood in front of her,
tall and gray-haired, with a jagged scar along one side of his face and a pants leg that ruffled against a prosthetic.
Jamie.
He pulled her into his arms, whispering McGrath again into her ear. Just that, being called McGrath again, hearing his voice, feeling his breath on her neck, sent her back to the O Club, beaded curtain clattering, the Beatles singing, Jamie asking her to dance.
Jamie,
she whispered.
How?
He reached into his pocket and pulled out a small gray stone that read, You fight, McGrath. The stone she'd been given by the young Vietnamese boy in the orphanage and which she'd slipped into Jamie's duffel bag.
It was a hellhole over there, and worse when we got home,
he said quietly.
But you got me through it, McGrath. Remembering you got me through.
I saw you die.
I died lots of times, he said. They kept dragging me back. I was in bad shape for a long time. My injuries. Christ, look at me.
You're still as handsome as ever,
Frankie said, unable to look away.
My ex-wife would disagree.
You're not...
It's a long, sad story, with a happy ending for both of us. I stayed with her for years. We had another baby, a girl. She's 9 and a real spitfire.
He stared down at her.
Her name is Frances.
Frankie didn't know how to respond. It was hard to draw a breath.
How about you?
He said, trying to smile.
Married? With kids?
No, Frankie said. Never married. No kids.
I'm sorry,
he said quietly. He, of all people, knew how much she'd wanted that life.
It's okay. I'm happy.
She gazed up at him. On his face, she saw all that he'd been through. The jagged jawline scar, the pucker of skin along one ear, the sadness in his eyes. His blonde hair was long now, threaded with gray, a reminder that they'd been young once together, but weren't anymore, that there were scars on both of them, wounds that remained, seen and unseen.
God, I've missed you,
he said in a cracked, scratchy voice.
I've missed you too, Frankie said. You could have found me.
I wasn't ready. It's been rough, healing.
Yeah,
Frankie said.
For me too.
But we're here now,
he said.
You and me, McGrath. Finally.
He gave her a smile that made her feel young again. For a moment, time fell away. They were Frankie and Jamie again, walking through camp, keeping each other upright, sharing their lives, laughing and crying together, loving each other. She felt the start of tears, felt them on her face as she stood there, surrounded by her fellow Vietnam veterans, the wall of black granite blurring behind them. Jamie moved toward her, stumbled. She reached out to steady him.
I've got you,
she said, her words echoing his from long ago. There was so much to say to him, words she'd gathered and stored in her memories, dreamed of saying. But there would be time for that, time for them. Today, just being here, holding his hand was enough. More than enough. Miraculous. After all these years, so much pain and regret and loss, they were here, she and Jamie and thousands of others, battered and limping and in wheelchairs, some of them, but still here. All of us, together again, in a group at a wall that held the names of the fallen. Together. Survivors all. They'd been silenced, forgotten for too long, especially the women. Remembering you got me through. And there it was. Remembrance mattered. She knew that now. There was no looking away from war or from the past, no soldiering on through pain. Somehow, Frankie would find a way to tell the country about her sisters, the women with whom she'd served, for the nurses who had died, for their children, for the women who would follow in the years to come.
It started here. Now. By speaking up, standing in the sunlight, coming together, demanding honesty and truth, taking pride. The women had a story to tell, even if the world wasn't quite yet ready to hear it. And their story began with three simple words. We were there.
Author's note. This book has been a true labor of love, years in the making. I first conceived of it in 1997, but as a young writer, I wasn't ready to tackle such an important and complex subject. I didn't feel I had the skill or the maturity to achieve my vision. It has taken me decades to circle back to the Vietnam War era. I was young, in elementary or middle school, for the majority of the war. But I remember it vividly. The protests, the darkening tone of the nightly news, the arc of the story told by the media, more and more young men dying, and most of all, how the veterans, many of them my friends' fathers, were treated when they came home. All of it made a lasting impression. Reading the firsthand accounts of the women who served in Vietnam was incredibly inspiring. I was also really saddened to realize that these women's heroic stories have too often been forgotten or overlooked. Not enough has been made or recorded or remembered about their service. It is even difficult to get certain agreed-upon numbers of the women who served in Vietnam. According to the Vietnam Women's Memorial Foundation statement, approximately 10,000 American military women were stationed in Vietnam during the war. Most were nurses in the Army, Air Force, and Navy, but women also served as physicians and medical personnel and in air traffic control and military intelligence. Civilian women also served in Vietnam as news correspondents and workers for the Red Cross, Donut Dollies, the USO, Special Services, the American Friends Service Committee, Catholic Relief Services, and other humanitarian organizations. Talking to these remarkable women, listening to their stories, and reading their firsthand accounts of both being in Vietnam during the war and their treatment upon coming home to the United States has been a revelation. Many of the women keenly remembered being told often that there were no women in Vietnam. I am honored to tell this story. Acknowledgements. This book would not have been possible if not for the help, guidance, honesty, and support of Captain Diane Carlson Evans, a former Army nurse who served in Vietnam. As the founder of the Vietnam Women's Memorial Foundation, she has dedicated much of her post-war life to remembering her sister veterans who served in the war. Her own story, told in Healing Wounds, written with Bob Welsh, is a stunning and revelatory look at how she saw her wartime experiences and was a great help in writing this novel. My gratitude is boundless, Diane. You are truly an inspiration. I'd also like to thank retired Army Colonel Douglas Moore, dust-off helicopter pilot and recipient of the Distinguished Service Cross, awarded to him for actions during the Vietnam War. Doug flew 1,847 combat missions, evacuated nearly 3,000 wounded, and was inducted into the Dust-Off Hall of Fame in 2004. Thank you for taking the time to read and critique an early draft of The Women and for answering an endless series of follow-up questions. Thanks to Debbie Alexander Moore, Army Special Services Recreation Director, Vietnam 1968-70, for her help and recollections. Thank you to Dr. Beth Parks, who served as an Army operating room nurse at the 7th Surgical MASH and 12th Evacuation Hospitals at Cu Chi, Vietnam, in 1966-67. Dr. Parks is now a retired professor and an adventurer, writer and photographer. She read the manuscript in record time, shared her personal photographs and memories, and added her experience and expertise throughout. I am eternally grateful for her help. For those who would like to read more about the remarkable women who served in Vietnam and their return from the war, I can recommend a few outstanding resource books. Healing Wounds by Diane Carlson Evans with Bob Welsh, American Daughter Gone to War by Winnie Smith, Home Before Morning by Linda Vandevanter, Women in Vietnam, The Oral History by Ron Steinman, A Piece of My Heart by Keith Walker. See also After the Hero's Welcome by Dorothy McDaniel, The League of Wives by Heath Hardage Lee, In Love and War by Jim and Sybil Stockdale, and The Turning, A History of Vietnam Veterans Against the War by Andrew Hunt. In writing this novel, I have tried to be as historically accurate as possible. Originally, I created fictional towns and evacuation hospitals to give myself the greatest possible fictional latitude in telling this story. But my Vietnam veteran readers felt strongly that I should name the places accurately. Therefore, the hospitals and towns mentioned in the novel are all real. The logistics and descriptions and timeline in a few places have been altered to support my narrative. Any errors or mistakes are, of course, my own. I'd also like to thank Jackie Dolat for her candid remembrances of Alcoholics Anonymous and rehab programs in Southern California in the 70s. I am grateful for the many people who work with me to make me a better writer. I am especially grateful to my early readers who speak their minds with sharp honesty and sometimes loudly. Jill Marie Landis, Megan Chance, Ann Patty, and Kim Fisk. And as always, my thanks to Jennifer Enderlin, whose passion for publishing and eagle-eyed editing mean the world to me. Her insightful critique truly made this book what it is. Thanks to the stellar team at St. Martin's. I love working with all of you. And to Andrea Cirillo, Rebecca Shearer, and the gang at Jane Rottrosen Agency, we have been partners in this crazy world of publishing for more than 2 decades, and I can't imagine my life without you all. As always, I thank my family for continual support and encouragement, especially my husband, Ben, who gamely travels and listens and bears with an author wife who is sometimes sitting right at the dinner table but is far away in her thoughts. To my mother, the memory of you during the war years is indelible. Thank you for believing so strongly in what was right. And to my dad, thank you for your adventurous spirit and for opening my eyes to the world beyond my own backyard. To Debbie Edwards John, thank you more than I can possibly say for all that you do. To my son Tucker, I am proud of you and I adore you. And to Mackenzie, Logan, Lucas, Katie, Kaylee, and Braden, may you love, read, and learn about history. You are the future. Finally, I'd like to mention a man I've never met, Colonel Robert John Welsh, Air Force pilot, who was shot down and lost in Vietnam on January 16, 1967. He never came home. I first got his prisoner of war bracelet when I was in elementary school and wore it for many, many years. My thoughts and prayers have stayed with his family for all of these years.
This is Julia Whalen. Thank you for listening to The Women, a Macmillan audio production from St. Martin's Press. This program was produced by Katie Robitsky, post-production by Tim Franklin. Text copyright 2024 by Kristen Hanna. Production copyright 2024 by Macmillan Audio. All rights reserved. For more information about Macmillan audiobooks, please visit macmillanaudio.com.